This is Josh Barrow, and welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. It's the middle of August, and this week the Trump administration announced a major change to immigration policy that has gotten less notice than I think it deserves. This change is coming by regulation rather than legislation. The administration is changing how it interprets a long-standing law that says people who are likely to become, quote, public charges, unquote, are ineligible for green cards. Customs and Immigration Services has long taken a narrow view of this law, holding it only bars people who are likely to be primarily dependent on benefits. Few green card applications get denied on these grounds. But the Trump administration now says it will consider past or likely future acceptance of a broad array of government benefits as evidence that a potential immigrant might become a public charge, even if that person works or is in a household with other workers. The likely effect of this rule is a significant reduction in the number of green cards that will be issued, especially on the basis of family links to American citizens. Later in the show, Randy Capps from the Migration Policy Institute will join us to talk about how this rule could reshape immigration to the United States. We will also talk later with Michael Davis about the rising tension in Hong Kong and what it could mean for U.S.-China relations. But now let's bring in our left, right, and center panel. As always, I'm your center, and I'm joined by Tim Carney, commentary editor at the Washington Examiner on the right, and on the left is Helene Olin of the Washington Post. Hello.
Hi.
Hi, Josh.
So there was other news this week. One thing I've been watching is the wild week in financial markets, driven by increasing worries about the global economy. And I was interested in how the president is responding to this. You can see on Twitter, he's out there proclaiming that the economy is so great and amazing, and also saying that what's wrong with the economy is the fault of a media that's out to get him and a Federal Reserve that is failing to do its job. The Washington Post reports the president is nervous, that he's been calling business leaders to get their sense of the economy, and he's receiving mixed reports. He also thinks the worsening forecasts we see are being done by people who don't like him and want to see him lose. The Post also reports, quote, administration officials are not actively planning for a recession because they do not believe one will occur, and they worry that making such plans would validate a negative narrative about the economy and precipitate a crash, according to people involved in internal discussions, unquote. Tim, that doesn't sound very wise to me.
No, I think that Donald Trump, he has always sort of overestimated his own ability, the president's ability to manage the economy. And he's completely disregarded the idea that something like a Federal Reserve should be independent. That's the idea of something being independent of Trump while in the federal government is totally foreign to him. And so the way that he's now saying, well, the economy is going to tank if I lose, does strike me definitely as an irresponsible way to talk. But the funny thing, Josh, is that it's kind of another example of Trump just sort of mainlining the way politicians have always been. He says directly and explicitly what politicians have always implied. Reagan says you don't leave a horse midstream. Obama said the same thing. The recovery's on the way and Romney's going to derail it. Trump is kind of just saying it just, you know, without any sort of filter or subtlety.
Yeah, Helene, I sort of see two things happening here. One is I think the president misestimates the effects of his own economic policies. He really doesn't buy the idea that the China trade war would have a negative effect on the economy, although maybe he buys it at least a little bit because he put off some of his proposed tariffs for a few months to avoid the holiday shopping season. But the other thing which Tim gets at there is the president doesn't exactly control the economy. Even the Federal Reserve doesn't exactly control the economy. And so there can be economic risks that arise independent of him. I think a lot of these global risks we're seeing, Trump is maybe exacerbating them, but he didn't create them. So he should be worried about a recession that isn't his fault, even if he's not worried that his own economic policies could cause a recession.
I always say the way to understand Trump is to understand he came out of the self-help guru world, right? And that this is the way they talk in that world. He was basically a wealth guru who tried to talk up the idea that he had the way you can make money. And a sort of a fake it till you make it strategy, a belief in yourself strategy, a say you're going to do it and you will do it strategy. And, you know, it's just traditional sales. You've got a problem. Here's the solution. And I'm the guy to give it to you. Now, of course, it changes every day what he will do to make it better for you. But that's basically where he's coming from. And that's what he sounds like when he talks like this.
Does the president have a point about the Federal Reserve? he's not alone in saying that the Fed raised rates too early, that it ought to be cutting rates right now. It's, again, you know, the Fed can't fix every problem that arises in the economy. It can't undo any problem that he causes through the trade war, but it can help. And I think, you know, we've seen a lot of criticism in past recessions, basically, that the Fed wasn't active early enough in cutting rates.
Yeah, the Fed has always sort of been more afraid of inflation than anything else, it's always seemed to me. And it is absolutely true that there's tons of people, and it's funny to see on Twitter the people who are saying, actually, Trump kind of has a point here. It's a very uncomfortable thing because it's not, you know, it's not Trumpers and it's not even necessarily conservatives who are the ones out there saying it. That right now what we see is this threat of a recession, and it's not surprising. And so it's only now that the Fed is cutting rates. So he's not alone in saying it by any means. And my worry, what I always get bugged about in the Trump administration is that anytime he says something, it immediately becomes a bad, horrible idea to 90% of our commentariat. And it's happening again with his comments on interest rates.
Yeah, I would agree with Tim about that part, that whenever Trump says something, everybody immediately jumps on it. But what I would say, he's also been bullying the Fed. There's no question about it. So this is also a problem of Trump's making. So that now, whatever the Fed does, it's perceived as doing something in relation to Trump, which leaves the Fed in a particularly terrible position. Because whatever they do will be seen as somehow reactive, and therefore Trump bullied them into it.
Yeah, it could actually tie the Fed's hands a little bit, make it harder for them to ease because it'll look like they did it because the president told them to. Tim, what have you been watching this week?
The craziest story at the end of the week had to do with Donald Trump telling Benjamin Netanyahu not to let in two U.S. congresswomen, Israel agreeing, and then changing its mind on one of them. And then that one, Rashida Tlaib, decided not to go to Israel anyway in order to visit her family. So it was just this sort of insane four-step dance that never used to happen before Trump, but it also never used to happen before this class of congresswomen. This was about Donald Trump saying you shouldn't let these congresswomen in, and it wasn't just because the justification wasn't just that Trump didn't like them. That's why Trump said it. Justification is Israel has a law against giving visas to people who are active public sort of official supporters of the boycott and divestment movement, BDS, of Israel. And so they were asking basically for a waiver because they were members of U.S. Of the Congress, and they didn't get it. But then in the end, Rashida Tlaib was given permission to enter. She was going to visit her grandmother, and she decided on Friday that she wasn't actually going to go. So what was going on here was sort of unprecedented but typical Trump muscle flexing over, you know, over social media and that sort of thing. But then both Israel and Rashida Tlaib showing that what was going on was all kind of a farce. It was a show, and it did not look like a good faith effort by these Democratic congresswomen to go there and better understand the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. It looked like an attempt to try to pick a fight with Israel, and by Israel, it looked like something just about as shameful.
Yeah, the episode at the end of it where Tlaib, you know, saying that she doesn't want to go under the restrictions that Israel would impose seems fine enough, except that she sent a letter saying that she was willing to submit to the restriction that she wouldn't advocate for BDS while she was in the West Bank and Israel. So why do you send that letter if you're then going to refuse that condition once you're granted permission to travel? But I thought earlier in the week, with Trump very privately and then publicly pressuring the Israeli government into blocking the admission of these two members of Congress that Israel appeared to be inclined to let in, Helene, it sort of, in a weird way, seemed to me like Trump was treating Israel the way he treats moderate Republican members of Congress who are seeking re-election in swing districts, which is to say, Israel for decades has benefited from broad bipartisan support in Washington. They try to cultivate constituencies in the Republican and the Democratic Party in a way that makes a lot of sense. You don't want foreign policy toward your country to swing too wildly between administrations on both sides. And it's clear that Israel did not want to pick this fight, didn't want to get crosswise with otherwise pro-Israel Democrats in Congress who wanted these members of Congress admitted to Israel. And also, you didn't want the PR win, essentially, for critics of Israel who would say, see, it's an illiberal country that won't allow critics in. Israel seemed to be inclined to allow this, but Trump forced their hand because he had his own domestic political prerogatives where he wants to elevate Tlaib and Omar and other members of the squad in Congress. And so basically, he forced Israel into a position where they had to do something that I think was against Israel's geopolitical interests because it served Trump's domestic political interests, which is a weird thing to do when he's holding himself out there as an ally of Israel.
Right. And I think one of the interesting sort of subplots to all of this has become the relationship between Trump and the American Jewish community, which is that, you know, Trump is desperate for the support of the American Jewish community. And he sort of couches a lot of this stuff in a way that he wants it to appeal to the American Jewish community. And yet all he's actually doing is increasing the wedges between the American Jewish community, which for the most part has continued to not support Trump, and the Israelis, who mostly do, and in part or often, as in this case, sort of being forced to support a Trump policy. In a way, he's actually hurting his own, quote, cause, so to speak.
But he's also hurting the Democrats because he is elevating Ilhan Omar and Rashida Tlaib, who have a past of anti-Semitism, and the organization that was sending them there certainly has a past of anti-Semitism. And so while Democrats and, you know, the New York Times are trying to make the story of 2020 be that Republicans are a bunch of racists, Trump is doing a very good job of highlighting the bigotry that resides in the Democratic Party, and that people like Nancy Pelosi certainly don't want to go to war with their much more popular freshman congresswomen. So Trump highlighting them, you know, I'm not going to say it helps the Republicans or helps him or who it helps at all. It hurts the Democratic Party to have these people be made the face of the party because of their dalliances with anti-Semitism.
I think that remains to be seen. I mean, I think in 2018, you saw efforts by Trump and Republicans to create this narrative around the election that really focused on sort of, you know, the sort of, you know, scary, risky, you know, border crisis stuff. And I think that their ability to divert voters' attention toward a specific villain, I think, was limited. It worked in 2016 because Hillary Clinton was who they made the villain, and Hillary Clinton was the Democratic nominee. Mm-hmm. I think it's going to depend a great deal on who Democrats nominate for president and what that person's alignment is within the party in terms of, you know, what Trump can force in terms of emphasis for Democrats. And I think that brings us, Helene, to something you've been watching this week.
Yeah, I've been watching the sort of constant talk about the Democrats' presidential election and electability, and specifically women within it. Women have been at the vanguard of opposition to Trump. There was the Women's March. The 2018 midterms saw a record number of women now elected to Congress. We've got several female politicians running for president, including Elizabeth Warren, Kamala Harris, Amy Klobuchar, Kirsten Gillibrand, and Tulsi Gabbard. And I'm not going to dignify Marianne Williamson's vanity project here. But they are not leading in the polls. And one of the things that seems to be leading them back, even as Elizabeth Warren in particular seems to be doing better, is that voters appear to be afraid of supporting them. And the reason they are afraid of supporting them is because they are women. Reporters who are going out in the field are hearing this repeatedly over and over again, that a woman can't win. There's some polling data to show that when people say generic Democrat versus Trump, generic Democrat wins, then they say, what about a woman? Suddenly it falls below, you know, the safe margin for Democrats. And ultimately, this sort of becomes a circular logic where people aren't supporting a woman because she's a woman and they're afraid she can't win, and therefore they won't support her.
Helene, I think one point of difficulty when doing this sort of analysis is obviously that generic Democratic woman is never on the ballot. It's always a specific person. There was this article in the New York Times this week about these electability concerns specifically as applied to Elizabeth Warren. And I think part of the difficulty is you get several concerns expressed at once, and it's difficult to figure out which of them voters are focused on both for themselves as reasons that they might object to Warren and reasons that they might worry that other people in the electorate might object to her. The Times, this is a quote from the Times story. It's, these Democrats worry that her uncompromising liberalism would alienate moderates in battleground states. Many fear Ms. Warren's past claims of Native American ancestry would allow Mr. Trump to drown out her policy message with his attacks and slurs against her. There are concerns about her, quote, professorial style, which I think in fairness is sort of coded language about her being a woman. And then finally, there are concerns about, you know, does the result in 2016 suggest to us that the electorate doesn't want a female Democratic candidate? And I think part of the concern is, you know, those are four somewhat different electability concerns. There's good political science research that does suggest that more ideologically extreme candidates tend to do worse in general elections, all things being equal, than more ideologically moderate candidates. And since Elizabeth Warren is the most successful, highest polling female candidate, I sort of feel like we can't separate these two questions about, you know, should we worry about Warren's electability because the electorate might react negatively to a female candidate versus should we worry about Warren's electability because the electorate might react negatively to a more left-leaning candidate.
But then you get into why are women being held to certain standards that men don't seem to be held to? I mean, Trump also has a nasty nickname for Biden, and I'm not repeating either of these names. I don't want to dignify them on the air. But the fact is that doesn't get as much attention, even though you do hear about it fairly frequently. And Biden's frequently making gaffes that are feeding the argument. Within the past week, he's confused Margaret Thatcher and Theresa May, not for the first time. He claimed to have met with Parkland victims while he was vice president, which would be really hard because that didn't happen when he was vice president. And I'm not saying this to condemn him, but I'm pointing out the sort of sexism involved where Warren makes one mistake and you hear about it over and over and over again. But then Biden, you know, is somehow the pro-union guy who somehow is being funded by lobbyists who are fighting unions. But nobody highlights that stuff. And I agree, it gets very hard to sort out. But one of the reasons it gets very hard to sort out is because so many people are just looking to jump on Warren or Kamala Harris.
I agree. And when I read with a lot of what you say, but on some of it, I disagree. When I read your piece, Helene, I was reminded of being in Iowa about a year before the caucuses in 08 and Democrats sort of almost skipping over Barack Obama and going for Edwards because they said, oh, I don't think a black guy could win. But then when about a week before Iowa, the self-fulfilling prophecy sort of was punctured and he goes ahead, wins Iowa, the nomination and the presidency. So I do think that that is a phenomenon. But I would say this, I also think that being a woman is going to be an advantage in the Democratic primary and to some extent in the general election. And one of the problems is, yes, Kamala Harris and Elizabeth Warren have other negatives and things that make people worry about their electability. And then you've got so many women out there that if there were one woman running right now, whether it was Elizabeth Warren or somebody perceived as more moderate like Amy Klobuchar, I think that person would be running away with the Democratic nomination right now. That Biden would still be sitting at 25% and you'd have somebody sitting there at 50% because so many people think that the way to beat Trump or that what this country needs now is a woman. And in the general election, I think that the swing population, one big part of it is college-educated suburban women. And so the idea that there's a disadvantage for women is true, but there's also an advantage. And I think that it's entirely possible that on net, it's going to be beneficial to be a woman in the 2020 election.
I want to take a break here. I will be back with Tim Carney of The Washington Examiner and Helene Olin of The Washington Post to talk about immigration. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
What do you think? Share your thoughts on today's show on our Facebook page or tweet us at LRCKCRW and download the KCRW app to listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Josh Barrow of New York Magazine. On the right is Tim Carney, commentary editor at The Washington Examiner. On the left is Helene Olin, columnist at The Washington Post. As I discussed at the start of the show, the Trump administration has issued a rule that will, starting in October, make it significantly harder to get a green card. Like before, potential permanent residents will have to show that they're not likely to become a public charge, dependent on the government. But the definition of who's a public charge will be greatly broadened. People who are likely to qualify for certain government benefits like food stamps and Medicaid may be considered public charges even if they or other members of their household have significant labor income. But an immigrant in a household that makes at least 250% of the federal poverty level, which is about $64,000 for a family of four, will be strongly presumed not to be likely to be a public charge. So this is a rule that is designed to strongly favor immigrants who are already solidly in the middle class or affluent before they become permanent residents of the United States. To discuss what this rule will do and whether it's actually within the Trump administration's legal authority to implement, we're joined now by Randy Capps. Randy is the director of research at the Migration Policy Institute. Hi, Randy.
Hi, how are you?
Good. So the first question I have about this rule is that it seems vague in certain ways. It sets out a lot of things that might make you a public charge or might make you not a public charge, but they're not bright line rules. They're factors that an immigration officer is supposed to weigh in deciding whether or not to issue a green card. So I guess the question is, do we know how big an effect this rule is likely to have? How do we know that when this rule is applied, how many people will be denied green cards who otherwise would have gotten them?
It really depends on the discretion of the immigration officer. The rule, as you said, mentions a list of factors: age, educational attainment, English proficiency, income, employment, and health insurance coverage that are factors that an immigration officer can weigh. And some of them are positive and some of them are negative and some of them are heavily weighted and some of them are not. But there's a lot of factors in the rule, and there's no standard as to how many things have to count for or against someone for them to get a green card. When we analyzed data on recent lawful permanent residents as a proxy for those who would be applying, you know, we found that 69% of them had at least one of these negative factors, 43% had two, and 17% had three. So you can see if it's one strike against you or two strikes or three strikes, it'll have a really big difference on how many people and which types of people can get into the country.
Can the administration do this? It's both an enormous change in policy, or at least potentially an enormous change in policy, without a new law, and one that seems vague and like you could have, you know, lots of discretionary decisions that mean similarly situated immigrants who get before different immigration officers get different decisions. Are they really able to impose a rule like this?
There's a legal basis for the rule. The concept of public charge has been in U.S. immigration law for over 100 years, and it was amplified in 1996 in the immigration law, which not coincidentally passed at the same time as the Welfare Reform Act passed. And so the concept that someone shouldn't be a burden on the government, they shouldn't be dependent on the government for assistance, is longstanding in U.S. immigration law. So that's the foundation for it. The issue is, how do you define public charge? Is this definition too broad? Is it an end run around Congress because it's really reshaping legal immigration to look more like the merit-based proposals that were introduced in Congress that the Trump administration wanted to see passed and didn't pass? We'll see. It's already been challenged in court by several states.
So my question, though, is, so the law does say explicit, I mean, not in very precise terms, but that you should not be granted, you know, your permanent residency if you are likely to be a public charge. And what this is doing simply is, in part, just expanding the class of benefit programs that count as public charge, right? Like, so Medicaid used to not really count, and now some Medicaid services do. And this wouldn't go after refugees or asylum seekers. So we still sort of have this idea that if you're persecuted, you're welcome, and even if you're going to be on welfare. And we still have the idea that there are all sorts of programs, including CHIP and programs for young people, that they're not going to be, you know, kicked out because they took some welfare or public aid when they were teenagers. So you say it's drastic, but it is taking what is the law and interpreting it differently. I'm very sensitive to presidents abusing power, but this doesn't look like an abuse of power to me.
Well, there's two things going on in the law. First of all, is this expansion of the list of public benefits, and it's a broad, much broader list. Far more people use food stamps and Medicaid than use cash assistance, which is what's in the old rule, essentially. Mm-hmm. But the reality is that there's almost no immigrants who can get these benefits before they become green card holders. I mean, certainly, if they're applying from outside the United States, they're not going to have access to U.S. benefits. Mm-hmm. And they're barred legally under the Personal Responsibility Act from getting food stamps and Medicaid, you know, unless they're children, and children are exempted from the rule, before they get a green card. So, like, the universe of people who are going to be excluded because they already use benefits is going to be very small. The big exclusion is the forward-looking test, the age, the education, the English language proficiency, income and assets, and all of these things. And the issue there is that it's very broad. Now, the law does specify that the federal government can use these factors mm-hmm. to make people inadmissible, ineligible for a green card, but it doesn't specify how. And what the rule does, I think, is expands the scope so much that a really wide variety of people could be excluded under these terms.
Yeah, so what I see is two, as I'm a conservative, I see two sort of conflicting poles here. One is, yes, U.S. immigration law should make it so that immigration is helping Americans. It's immigration law is not there to serve the rest of the world. It's our law. It's there to serve us. And that there's something to be said that people shouldn't come here to use our welfare. So those two principles in one direction. But the way you're describing it does bug me to think that there are federal bureaucrats who can look at it and with somebody not having used welfare do some sort of math and say, I think you're going to go on welfare. I think you're going to go on Medicaid. That is a discretion of federal agents that I find worrisome. Is that what you're saying is a big problem?
Yeah, the discretion here is actually the thing I worry about the most. And if I had to imagine a successful court case, it probably would be on the basis of discretion, not on the basis of whether or not the law authorizes this, but the reality that, you know, a bureaucrat in the State Department or in the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services is going to look at a long laundry list of things. I mean, in the form that they're publishing alongside the rule asks all sorts of things. It asks credit ratings. It asks for proof that people aren't income eligible for benefits. It asks even more detail than what the rule itself asks for. But it also doesn't spell out how many of these things you have to check off before you don't get a green card. What's really going to be important, I think, in the next few weeks and then once the rule goes into effect in the middle of October, is to find out what are the instructions that the bureaucrats are getting, the adjudicators at USCIS, the overseas consular officials. Are those instructions going to narrow their discretion somewhat? Are they going to actually be given instructions that they deny as much as possible if any of these factors are negative? And I mean, given, you know, what we've seen from this administration, how they've implemented other immigration rules, I'm very worried about that.
Helene, what do you make of this?
I think there's a bunch of different things going on. I think, first of all, to assume that because it won't impact, you know, refugees or children, that people then won't turn around and apply, you know, will go, oh, okay, I can apply for benefits for them, is to be a little bit willfully naive. I think people are very scared in this climate and that people who would deserve these benefits would potentially not apply. And I think that's part of Trump's thinking, because I think one of the things that's going on here is this combines two of Trump's favorite groups to attack, immigrants and people who receive social welfare benefits. Something that is part of this discussion that really doesn't come up very often is that it's worth remembering the Trump administration has attempted to impose massive benefit cuts on SNAP, housing assistance, HEAD assistance, Medicaid, and the like. At the same time, he's allowing states to impose work requirements on Medicaid. He's all about giving to the wealthy, but somehow punishing anybody else who needs assistance. And I think you have to understand this as coming not just from his immigration policy, but from his continued attacks on the safety net for all of us.
Randy, I think one thing that's important to note about this rule is the disproportionate effects that would have on people trying to immigrate to the U.S. from different regions of the world. It looks from your analysis like that this would have the least effect typically on people who are seeking to immigrate from Europe, Canada, Australia, and then countries that are mostly non-white, regions of the world that are mostly non-white, would be likely to have much higher percentages of denials of green card applications on the basis of this law. So it seems like an effect of this would be likely to significantly whiten the population that is authorized to permanently immigrate to the United States, which, you know, the president has talked about. You know, he wants more immigrants from countries like Norway. It seems like he's almost openly talked about the idea that immigration to the U.S. should be more white people and fewer non-white people.
I think that's partially true. Certainly, when we looked at the factors we could model in recent lawful permanent residents, you know, we found Europeans were the most likely to have the positive factors and the least likely to have the negative ones. And Latin Americans, you know, were the more likely group to be excluded. A lot of that has to do with educational attainment and English proficiency. But there are some nuances to that. If you look at individual countries, people from China are actually as likely to have a negative factor against them as people from Mexico, because so many of them are limited English proficient, compared to, say, India, Philippines. Those countries tend to send immigrants that are largely English proficient. Even in Africa, if you look at the major African countries like Nigeria and Ghana, a lot of the immigrants coming from them are highly educated and speak English. So this actually might favor some immigrants from Africa. In Africa, the least educated immigrants tend to be refugees, and they're exempt from it. So it would shift origins. It would shift them away from Latin America and towards Europe, but it's a much more of a mixed bag when it comes to other regions.
Yeah, I'm looking at the Migration Policy Institute's numbers, and it does jump out at me that Africa as a region, the immigrants from there, the recent, 41% had no negative factors. That's tied with Europe, Canada, and Australia in first place. And so it's not as simple a story as everybody's going to be whiter. It's, yes, we're going to have fewer Central and South American and Mexican immigrants, but it also could mean that our immigration makeup will be more African, in part because our African immigration population has, in recent years, been more educated than the average immigrant.
Tim, going back to the idea of doing this through executive action, isn't one problem with bypassing Congress when making a big policy change like this that even if you have a lot of people who are interested in changing to a more so-called merit-based immigration system, that all of these important decisions about factors and weights get made without the legislative process? I mean, for example, this idea of 250% of the poverty level, I realize that's a guideline. It doesn't mean that no one will be able to get a green card if their family income is lower than that. But it seems to me that a rule that says basically you have to be already middle class in order to get a green card to enter the United States through family unification or other methods that are not refugee status, it seems to me like that goes against the history of U.S. immigration, where part of the story is about people being able to better themselves, come to the United States to opportunity. I don't know that if we put this through Congress, even a Republican Congress, that we would come up with a rule that was so stringent as to basically say you have to already be doing pretty well economically in order to be allowed to come here.
Yeah, and I mean, well, you're pointing to some extent at the sort of impossible vagueness of the operative law here. There is a law that says that does instruct the federal agencies to not allow the entry, the naturalization, the green cards of people who are likely to become public charges. So that law itself bucks against what you're rightly describing as something of a tradition. But you're also right that Congress would, if they were, I mean, our view at the Washington Examiner is that Congress ought to pass a law that does something like this. But in a congressional debate, assuming we had a functional Congress that could pass laws, you would have a debate over things like, well, should we care about income? Because one of the Trump administration defenses of this is, well, no matter how poor you are, no matter where you're coming from, if you work hard enough, you should be able to basically avoid becoming a public charge. Well, if we're looking at what your income is the day that you land, then that's not addressing that. So I do agree that a congressional debate would have different contours here. But the general idea that we want to – that the way that a lot of liberals say, oh, well, immigration is great, is by pointing to the fact that people who come here want to come and be self-starters and all of that. And so that is if you oppose a public charge rule, then you're saying that was a lie. You're saying, oh, no, we do want anybody to show up here, even if we don't think that they're going to be able to contribute to the economy.
But Helene, I don't think that liberals necessarily oppose some sort of public charge rule, or that, you know, I mean, any immigration policy pretty much is going to have some factors that prefer certain people who would like to immigrate over others. So what is the appropriate approach to this from the left if this is the wrong approach? How should we think about evaluating the financial wherewithal and the likelihood of being a net fiscal contributor versus a net fiscal burden if we're making immigration policy?
Well, I think there's another thing that needs to be taken into account here, too, and that is what jobs do we need filled? One of the things Trump has talked about a lot is bringing in more high-skilled people, which is a valid point. But at the same time, what we're seeing right now is the jobs that are going wanting are actually not particularly high-skilled jobs. There was a story by one of my colleagues in the Post this week about the fact that it's almost impossible to get home health care workers up in Maine now. This is not a particularly technical job, and it's not going to be done by somebody somebody probably coming in with huge educational and middle class financial resources. At the same time, there were the raids on the chicken factories in Mississippi last week, and those jobs are also going wanting. Again, could they raise the salaries and get more Americans? Potentially, but probably not as many as we would like to think. So this also begs a bigger question of how are we going to reform our immigration policy so that we get what we need in this country while still trying to help people out as we have traditionally done in this country. And doing things like this, what Donald Trump is proposing, is just sort of in the end kind of incoherent, frankly.
Randy, if we assume, as has been the case for the last 30 years, that it is not possible to get a comprehensive immigration reform of any sort through Congress in this administration or the next one, where does this rule, assuming it goes into effect and survives legal challenges, where does it leave the next president? Can the next president just rescind this rule and basically write their own policy as they see fit on what a public charge is and therefore on who gets to immigrate to the U.S.?
Well, I mean, once it's a rule, it has the force of law, and it would take some time to do that. I mean, a revision to this rule would have to go through a public comment period that would be very extensive. I mean, this particular rule got 200,000 comments over a couple months. It took more than 6 months to review the comments. It wouldn't be something that could be reversed easily and automatically. But given that the rule is so vague and there's a lot of leeway in it, how it's implemented is going to make as big a difference as the rule itself. And there's a lot of leeway in the rule as written for another administration to interpret it in a much more modest way. For instance, the final rule includes a provision that it's a positive factor if someone is a parent or a caregiver of an elderly or disabled or ill person. And you could see another administration arguing, well, okay, if you have someone in the family, they don't work, they don't make that much income, but they're taking care of two kids, then they should be let in with a green card. So there's a lot of wiggle room in the rule as written.
Randy Capps is the Director of Research at the Migration Policy Institute. Randy, thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much.
Still with me are on the left, Helene Olin of The Washington Post, and on the right, Tim Carney of The Washington Examiner. And now it's time for Tweets of the Week. Sometimes it only takes 140 characters or maybe 280 to distill the spirit of the week. Helene Olin, what's your Tweet of the Week?
My tweet comes from the government of Greenland's Foreign Ministry Department. Greenland is rich in valuable resources such as minerals, the purest water and ice, fish stocks, seafood, renewable energy, and is the new frontier for adventure tourism. We're open for business, not for sale. Learn more at Greenland On, and they link to their official tourism site. This, again, is from the government of Greenland, responding to reports that Donald Trump thought the United States should consider buying the island of Greenland, a self-ruling part of Denmark. All I can say is we needed some comic relief this week. Congrats to Greenland for trying to make a buck off of Donald Trump's ignorance.
Tim Carney, what tweet struck you?
So as an opinion editor, sometimes an issue comes up and we know it really matters, but we're not entirely sure exactly what insightful original comment we can make on it. One of my editors at The Washington Examiner, Jason Russell, put on Twitter this week, quote, "My reaction to 90% of news is, quote, that person should not have done that." And this is exactly the situation we end up in. And sometimes I just wish that that could be our editorial, whether we're talking about a member of Congress, the president of the United States, or anybody who shows up in the news. Frankly, often the only comment to make is, that person should not have done that.
My tweet of the week comes from Ken White, my co-host on All the President's Lawyers, who has once again, perhaps against his better judgment, gotten into a flame war on Twitter with television lawyer Michael Avenatti, who's currently under federal indictment in New York and California. Avenatti says Ken only criticizes him because he's jealous. Ken replies, "I wouldn't say I'm jealous, but free rent and food for 180 to 210 months does have a certain appeal." I've been talking with Helene Olin of The Washington Post and Tim Carney of The Washington Examiner. We will be back with Michael C. Davis to talk about Hong Kong. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Join the conversation on our Facebook page or tweet us at LRCKCRW. Stream all episodes of Left, Right, and Center and other great shows at kcrw.com/podcasts.
On the newest episode of Nocturne.
It's completely dark. You take the headlamp off of your helmet and you're holding it in your teeth just to make sure your head can fit through the passage. people in the past who have visited this cave have described the sensation of being like trapped in a coffin. I'm thinking maybe this will be the trip into the cave where something snaps in my brain and it goes wrong.
Find Nocturne wherever you listen to podcasts.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm your host, Josh Barrow. On the right is Tim Carney, commentary editor at the Washington Examiner. On the left is Helene Olin, columnist at the Washington Post. Protests and disruptions continued in Hong Kong this week, including a shutdown of the territory's international airport. The protests began in the spring, sparked by a proposed law that would have allowed mainland Chinese courts to extradite people from Hong Kong, undermining the territory's autonomy. The protests have grown in response to perceived abuses by police and by gangsters, and in response to a sense that China threatens to abandon the one country, two systems approach that has provided economic and civil liberties in Hong Kong that are unavailable on the mainland. China is portraying the protests as violent, lawless, and a dangerous U.S.-backed movement for Hong Kong independence that undermines China's sovereignty. One big fear is that China will intervene militarily to put down the protests, and that that could mean a disaster both for freedom in Hong Kong and for China's economic and political relations with the West. To discuss that, we're joined now by Michael C. Davis. Michael is a global fellow at the Wilson Center and a senior research scholar at the Weatherhead East Asia Institute at Columbia University. Hi, Michael.
Hello.
So before we discuss the risks, can we talk a little bit about how we got here? Hong Kong was handed back to China 22 years ago. During that period, China has to greater and lesser extents respected the autonomy of Hong Kong. What upholds that system? What stops China from just treating Hong Kong like any other part of China?
Well, China obviously has a big investment in Hong Kong. Back when it was handed over, they would report that Hong Kong was about 25% of China's the size, its economy, 25% of that of China. Today, it's down to about 3%. It's not because Hong Kong's less important. It's just because China has grown much bigger. The 3% is very critical to China because it's mostly about finance and international trade and so on, where Hong Kong can operate sort of as a base, an off base from China with the rule of law. Hong Kong's rule of law is ranked among the highest in the world. It's ranked as one of the freest societies in the world. So Chinese businessmen, Chinese companies like to set up a base in Hong Kong. They list on the Hong Kong Stock Exchange, so they have a lot of reasons for carrying on with that. That gives them an up in terms of their relationship with international trade and business elsewhere. Inbound trade and stuff also passes through Hong Kong. A lot of big companies would prefer having their headquarters in Hong Kong, where, again, the rule of law protects them.
So what sort of leverage do the protesters and the people of Hong Kong have here? Because I think a lot of people internationally have been watching this and been very worried that we're going to see a Tiananmen-style intervention. Do the people of Hong Kong have reason to believe that they will be able to effectively put pressure on China to back off and respect their freedoms here?
Well, it seems that at least they believe that. The protesters have been pushing very hard. They apparently believe that China will not take the what's called the nuclear option and basically send in the People's Liberation Army and destroy this base from which both traders in and out operate. And Hong Kong people, of course, have a lot of sympathy in the world. So if Hong Kong starts looking like Tiananmen Square, that's going to be a huge cost for China. It may wind up with China being boycotted and all sorts of other things going on that China would not like. So I think, therefore, Beijing has held back. It held back in the past, especially 2014 when you had the protest over democratic reform. China just stayed out of it. I recall being on the street then and thinking, you know, are they, you know, going to send in the army? But they didn't. And because the cost would be very high for them to do that. And it's just also, you know, this one country, two systems model is a centerpiece of China's efforts to unify the country. And in some ways, that centerpiece is part of the base of Belt and Road and all China's initiatives to reach out to others. So if it is seen to be heavy-handed in Hong Kong with soldiers running around with guns, then I think a lot of China's neighbors will also be concerned about the direction things have taken.
Helene, one thing that has struck a lot of people about this over the past couple of months as these protests have gained momentum is how hands-off Donald Trump has been in terms of his comments about it, essentially suggesting that this is an internal Chinese issue. It seems in conflict with his general tough-on-China stance, although maybe what it indicates is that all he really cares about is trade policy with China, and he doesn't have any interest in putting pressure on China for other matters.
It also could indicate that, you know, Trump kind of likes the authoritarian style, and that's kind of what could be going on here, too. I mean, I'm not going to pretend I have the answers to what is going on there. I am far from an expert on this. But I think what we always have to remember is that Trump is something of a blowhard. He's something of an ignoramus that never stops him from saying anything or doing anything. So why isn't he saying anything here? You know, the only thing I can start thinking about is the fact that he has, you know, shown repeatedly that he likes the authoritarian style, whether that's Vladimir Putin, whether that's North Korea, or potentially whether that's China.
Isn't there a problem here where we don't know whether Trump saying anything will help? If the Chinese regime's criticism of these protesters is that these are puppets of America, then the U.S. president coming and saying, we stand behind you, which in some ways that would be great. That would be, you know, beacon of liberty sort of stuff reminiscent of the Cold War. I'd love it. But wouldn't that criticism take more hold? And could that in some ways almost weaken the protesters? It would be my question.
Well, you know, I think you can do that if you go too far, if the U.S. actually engages in ways that are somehow out on the street engaging with protesters. But that's not been the case. Everyone sort of knows these youngsters really aren't that much subject to U.S. diplomats. They might meet with them, but they really pretty much have a mind of their own. And I think Trump sends a signal that could cause a miscalculation on China's part. And I think this is the real danger here. Generally, the foreign governments that China has asked to treat Hong Kong separately have an interest in Hong Kong. The U.S. has 85,000 people there. There's, I think, 1,400 businesses based in Hong Kong in one way or another. So China has said, come and treat Hong Kong differently. We'll let you have the rule of law and everything here. So while China says, don't meddle in our internal affairs as a kind of PR position, they know that these countries have a real interest here, and it would behoove Trump to at least convey that interest. It seems like he's unaware of it, and I think this is the problem. He just seems to think that he can say nice things to Xi Jinping, and people on the street know it's all over this social media in Hong Kong. They know Trump is trying to use Hong Kong as a bargaining chip in this trade deal, and I think this is a matter of concern.
Yeah, Tim, I can think of three reasons why a more normal U.S. president might be more publicly forceful about this. One is the sort of Reagan-esque stuff you discuss about, you know, promotion of freedoms around the world. But there's also, as Michael notes, all these U.S. business interests in China. And then there's the issue of sending a warning. Basically, you know, we have a number of interests in Asia. There are a number of things where we would like China not to be too aggressive. And it seems that if we send a signal that it's okay that they can do this, what does that mean for Taiwan? What does that mean for the South China Sea, other places where we're concerned about containing China in this part of the world? It seems to send a signal that, you know, so long as they buy enough soybeans, they can do what they like.
I think you're exactly right. I actually agree with you. And that we know that China has very aggressive designs on the rest of the world. Their infrastructure investments in very predatory ways, you know, building ports, building transportation infrastructure, loading these small growing countries with debt, and then using that to hold power over them and then try to exert more influence over more of the globe is what they're doing. So in some ways, and what we argued in an editorial is that they're showing us a preview. In Hong Kong, they're showing us a preview of what's going to happen in the rest of the world. And so this is, I mean, if you wish that we were doing more in the U.S. to reach out to the people who are closer to China's orbit, we were doing that. It was something called the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and both parties kind of wanted to pull – I mean, certainly Trump wanted to pull out of that, and he has. And so we can't out-China China, but we could be showing them, hey, there's another way. Hong Kong is a perfect example of that. These guys are through commerce, trade, and enterprise, not through anybody else in showing any influence on them. They're thriving, and so it really would take engagement and sort of living free trade and commerce to combat China. And it's scary that China's showing us this preview and Trump's doing nothing.
Yeah, and it really, I think the danger here is a miscalculation by China. Actually, the State Department is sending a completely different signal than what Trump is sending, and so is the Congress. So, well, is China going to take Trump seriously, I guess, becomes the question. This is a big question across the whole trade war, is whether China actually takes Trump seriously because they know he's often at odds and doesn't seem to get a full grip on what the rest of his own administration is doing. So I guess that's sort of the saving grace, is maybe he's sending a bad signal, but maybe they won't take it too seriously. It's hard to say.
Michael C. Davis is Global Fellow at the Wilson Center and a Senior Research Scholar at the Weatherhead East Asia Institute at Columbia University. Michael, thank you very much for joining us.
You're welcome.
We've reached that time once again for our famed Left, Right, and Center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Helene Olin, what's your rant?
Unless you are living in a cave, you almost certainly know that pedophile and friend of presidents Jeffrey Epstein was found hanging in a Manhattan jail cell this weekend. The conspiracy theories began immediately, but instead of percolating up from places like 4chan, they came from mainstream media figures on Twitter. This is both wildly irresponsible and proof that Trump has driven no small number of people around the bend. Yes, an investigation by a trusted authority is needed, but conditions in prisons are a national disgrace, suicide rates are relatively high, and let me just say, as a fourth-generation New Yorker, that a pair of overworked and underpaid New York City prison guards didn't get off their butts to check on their celebrity prisoner as they were supposed to didn't exactly come as a shock.
Tim Carney, what's your rant?
I think there's a lot of irresponsibility going on here, too. But it's not just in the people who are spreading rumors about the nature of Jeffrey Epstein's death. Any talk of the irresponsibility ought to start with those in the ruling class of our country who allowed this whole travesty to occur. Jeffrey Epstein skated when it was known that he was involved in pedophilia, when it was known that he was involved in sex trafficking. He got a joke of a prison sentence last decade and was allowed to walk free. And it was because he was connected to people with power. And then his death in prison again shows incompetence. So the defense that there's not some conspiracy here is that this man who got away with horrific crimes for years was then left inadequately supervised in prison and able to kill himself when he should have been under closer watch. The irresponsibility that leads to people believing these conspiracy theories is an elite that is both corrupt and incompetent, and it leaves ordinary people to believe the worst about those in charge.
For my rant, this week, Governor Mike Parson of Missouri, a Republican, and Governor Laura Kelly of Kansas, a Democrat, signed an agreement to stop poaching businesses from across the border in the Kansas City area through subsidies and tax incentives. Parson tweeted, quote, "Incentivizing companies to move a few miles doesn't result in new jobs. We are realigning our economic development investments to better serve our taxpayers," unquote. He and Kelly are right. These subsidy wars are a negative-sum game that enrich businesses at taxpayer expense without creating new jobs. More states should find ways to come to a ceasefire. That's all we have time for today. I want to thank Tim Carney, Helene Olin, Randy Capps, and Michael Davis. Left, Right, and Center is produced by Sarah Fay. Our technical director is J.C. Swadek. Katie Berskins and Colin Cab Washington are our production assistants. And a special thank you to Katie. This is her last show with the Left, Right, and Center team. We're very grateful for her support. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. I'm Josh Barrow. Thanks for joining us. And tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.